What's up, everyone? Thanks for tuning in Asian Bitches Down Under, a podcast about sharing information and perspectives from the Asian diasporas in society and culture. We encourage you to subscribe to our show via Apple, Google, or Spotify. If you have enjoyed our episodes, please support us by giving us a 5-star rating and get your friends on board to listen to us. Finally, we would love you to support this podcast by donating to our Buy Me a Coffee program. Your wonderful support and donations will help us to continue creating the platform for diversity and inclusivity. Make sure you check out the episode show notes for any collaborations we're working with to promote. Thanks again, and we hope you will enjoy today's episode.
Hey y'all, this is Jessie.
Hi, this is Helen.
And we are Asian Bitches Down Under, recording on the last few days of the month of April.
Helen,
the sun is out. I went for a walk around the neighborhood, the river. It's very nice. You had dogs to accompany you. I had a couple of podcasts to accompany me. Namely,
that's what I do as well. Walking by myself. I'm not like disturbed by my
dogs,
husband or my kids. Because,
right,
you know, one of my child constantly talks all the time.
Yeah, it's adorable.
So during the walk with my kids, that she would just non-stop talking about her life, her school,
oh my God,
what she
I
thinks,
love
her opinion.
This. That's so cute. That's adorable.
Yeah, for those who doesn't know, my daughter speaks a lot, like excessively.
Oh
when
God,
she
I
doesn't
love her.
Stop.
I love
so she's
her.
Got her podcast herself.
Yeah.
Where she talks about animals and her own book reviews.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a book review. Seriously.
Yeah, it is book review. It's really
and,
cute.
And for those who want to know, it's Koala Explorer.
Mm-hmm.
You should totally get down on that.
And she loves telling jokes as well.
Oh, it's so adorable. Yeah.
Yeah. So coming back to my walk by myself, now she started turn two. I listen to, you know, Code Switch, The Argument, anything that's on NPR. What about you?
I listen, my favorite podcast is Billy and Drew's The Pilot Club, which is
back
this week.
Yes,
the most
amazing.
Exciting news of the century. This week they talk about Gaslit, which is the new Stan show. Julia Roberts and
Roberts,
Sean Penn on Stan.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Billy gave it a thumbs down, so I don't think I'm going to watch it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm also back, and honestly, the best human being, like the smartest human being on the planet, probably that I don't know, who I have not met yet, Wesley Morris, and still processing. This season he is interviewing people and going through different genres and topics. This week, season, Jenna Wortham is unfortunately not with him, which is kind of sad because I feel like I listen to the podcast a lot because of their dynamics, rapport is just extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Their friendship is so palpable and so delightful. They're just such delightful people. But, I mean, Wesley Morris, I just think I would listen to him just like I would listen to Billy talk about the paint on the wall or, like, the science behind the most dull thing ever. It's just they can make things really interesting and alive.
Uh-huh.
So,
that's a skill.
I know,
definitely.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And that's what I've been doing this morning. And it's sweating, a lot of sweating today.
Yeah, so humid.
A bit of humidity, Sydney's experiencing a bit of humidity today. But let's wrap up about our week and what we were watching, what we were reading. In terms of books, I don't have anything to... I've been kind of scattered in my reading. Oh, I'm still finishing every day going back to Nanette, 10 Steps to Nanette, which is Hannah Gatsby's book.
I'm still trying to finish that.
Yeah. My next book is Finding Me by Viola Davis, which is, you know, a memoir by obviously you guys all know who that extraordinary actress is. So I'm very excited to be picking up these memoirs by these extraordinary men. My gang and I are watching Gossip Girl, the original season, and going through it slowly. It's really awesome. It's very kind of like snappy, and the writing is quite good and sharp. So I personally can't wait to watch the reboot of it, which came out, I feel like, in the last 2 years. But Helen, did you ever get into the original Gossip Girl?
I feel like I never watched those kind of things.
Helen never got into all the things I was into.
I'm
like,
such a boring person. Like, I don't watch Sex and the City. I don't watch Friends. I don't
watch
Gossip
Friends?
Girls.
Basic people. Gossip Girl, yeah. Yeah, I guess some people might say Gossip Girl is quite basic, I remember really liking it just for its kind of voyeuristic sort of atmosphere. Like, I always felt like I was getting an insight into the really uber wealthy kids of New York City.
Yes.
And I guess that was like quite titillating.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. But obviously, I honestly, I don't know how believable it is that, because these kids, like Chuck, for instance, Chuck Bass, played by Ed Westwick, who has such a strange face. You can't really tell whether he's hot or ugly. but he is like, they're all very, very wealthy. Serena, Blair, Nate, they're all very, even Dan, who like, just because his dad's a muso and they live in like Brooklyn. And like back in the mid-noughties, Brooklyn was like seen as something other. Whereas now, obviously, Brooklyn is like, you know,
the center of everything.
Wealthy parts of the world, yeah. But like, it's so funny that just because Dan's character is like, his dad is like a musician, or like a former rock star, and also his dad is the most annoying character. It's like, oh, he's like poor, or he's like on the other, and it's just really funny. And all of them are obviously ludicrously good looking, but it's funny because like some of them get driven by a limo to get to their school, and it's like, does that really happen? Like, do private school kids really get driven in a limo to school?
I think some dramas do, like, overly dramatize a lot of scenes in, you know, maybe it does happen, but because we're in such a different world that we'll never know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I do wonder that. And it's really funny just the way in which these kind of series from the mid-noughties to, like, 2005 to 2010-ish, like the OC, where you have like the central lives of the people we're invested in are the teenagers, right?
Yeah.
But like their parents are also quite involved, and what really annoys us is the parents seriously look like the same age as these teenagers. It's ridiculous. It's so funny how like they just can't.
Yeah, like, because no, that's because they're rich. You know, they can get their Botox, they can get their facials, they can. I don't know. It's almost as if, you know, you don't see old people.
Oh, yeah, obviously.
But sets also, like this is because they kind of discriminate.
They have money.
The face of age, you know, of face. Yeah. When you're aging, you're not supposed to be on screen or something.
Yeah, no,
like
absolutely.
That.
But also the way in which they cast these teenage characters, like Serena van der Woodsen, who's played by Blake Lively. Like, she literally looks like she's 30 years old. When she's supposed to be playing a 16-year-old. It's just hilarious. It's really funny.
Yeah, but, it happens.
We're having a lot of fun watching it. A lot of fun, yeah. How about you? What have you been watching this week?
Okay, or reading? I finished Lonely Castle in the Mirror last weekend. It's by Mizuki Sugimura. So it's a Japanese translated work. Lonely Castle in the Mirror, it's very Japanese style, I have to admit. There's a lot of nuances around Japanese cultural and social interactions. Or rather, I should say that it's more like Asian style interactions. So, for example, like keeping distance with each other, the conversations are not very straightforward. Or even that you're very suspicious of someone new that you're meeting. The plot is about a girl named Kokoro, finding herself intertwined into this like a very messy high school relationship chaos where another girl accused her of stealing her crush. It's probably very similar to a lot of teenage genre drama in US. And that bully took a group of girls to her house and threatened her. And from there, she started stopping going to school, and out of nowhere, her mirror became like a portal where she can enter to a castle. And there she met a couple of children who happens to be the same situation as her, who refuses to go to school. So the book really depicts on the interaction of these seven children. They're all in high school age, their arguments, their obscure purpose in their lives. It's not really my type of book, to be honest. I think it's because it's more like a YA category in exploring friendship and navigating the coming to age sort of story. But apparently this book is rather popular in Japan and won several awards because it speaks to a lot of Japanese people's high school life being bullied.
Right, right.
And not conforming to society, like feeling ostracized, etc.
Mm.
So to me, I can resonate to the bully part, but throughout the whole book, just seeing the interaction of the seven kids is kind of agonizing for me, because none of them speaks directly or clearly to each other. Like, they don't convey what they want or what they need, especially the female characters. I guess it's because, you know, coming down to traditionally, that a lot of Asian females, that they were taught not to express yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you always have to put other people first. Yeah, I guess, I think it's more suitable for younger kids, maybe, mm-hmm. not my age.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
Okay. So speaking of what I watched, this week, my husband and I started watching Life and Beth, which is starring Amy Schumer.
Seriously, the best human being. Everything is the best for me. Yeah, I love Amy Schumer. Inside Amy Schumer is like the best show that was ever created, hands down.
We started watching out of nowhere. I was going to start watching Dropouts. You know,
the Dropout?
The Dropout. Yeah, it's based on the book.
Elizabeth Holmes' story.
Elizabeth, yeah, that's right. But then this came up because it's a shorter episode. It's like less than 30 minutes. So I can watch it at the end of the night, and I don't have to stay up late if I want to continue to watch another episode. It's kind of like a vibe between Fleabag, Shrew, and My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Oh, I like it.
I'm thinking that
that's such a nice combo.
Yeah, what's with the television making shows that portrays women in their 30s making decisions that are deemed to be like really bad by the society?
And like what?
It seems quite popular in the past 5 years. You know, I feel like the commonalities of these shows are like women in their 30s.
Single?
They're not exactly happy of where they are in their lives.
Yep,
they're not married. They might have a relationship, but it's usually very shitty.
Yeah, yeah.
And
they're white.
Have kids. And they're white, of course. And they have complicated parent and child relationship with either their mom or their dad.
Can I just say, you should make a list and start thinking about writing an essay about this, because I would really like to read this. Because, you're right. All of them are very similar.
Yeah, it's very similar. Like, I mean, why are these shows interesting? Is it because women around the world, or maybe in the Western country, feel like they resonate to it?
Yes.
You know, in their 30s, they're not going anywhere. Yeah. You know, they're not looking into a prospect of being married, or they don't have a career path that they can move upward to. Mm. Is it really portraying the reality? I feel like it's partially yes as well. Mm.
Yeah, I love that question, Helen. I think it's like the same reason why there's so much female literature out there that I really tears me to pieces seeing this shitty stuff that's coming out of Australian publishing. it just annoys me. But like, there are buyers. Like, people, the biggest buyers in Australia, like, books are white women, or like Australian women, like women between 25 and 65. Are the biggest demographic of book buyers, you know? And so it makes sense that we are getting a lot of books that are not just written by these women within these categories, but that center, that make the protagonist, you know, someone who fits into this identity group. And I think what's so appealing about these shows that you've mentioned, where, you know, we have, like, for instance, Fleabag and Life and Beth, Let Beth and Life, whatever it's called. It's like women want not just to see themselves, but to feel like it's okay to be in your 30s and not have it all together. Mm. I think women want to see their lives narrated back to them, even if it's a bit outlandish, even if it is a bit different. Like, I think every woman under this planet, under the sun, could have related somehow to the character of Fleabag, the kind of dysfunctional parent family, the sister. The relationship with the sister was amazing. It was so beautiful.
I was actually the funniest bit, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I love her sister so much.
I think it's very similar in Life and Beth. There's a very strange sister relationship with Amy Schumer's character and the sister. Yeah.
Yeah, and in Trainwreck, she has a really interesting relationship with her sister there, you know, played by... what was her name? Brie Larson. Yeah.
Uh-huh, okay.
But yeah, like, all of these things, these tropes, I guess, women relate to it and they see it themselves. Even if you're happily married with kids, like, you want to see what's out there. We just want, like, more versions of women in their 30s.
Yes.
This might be, Helen, I'm thinking just now, this might be something to do with the fact that I'm now about to hit my mid-30s, mm-hmm. like, smack on mid-30s. But, like, I feel like it's, I'm no longer interested in seeing some narrative about a younger woman. I'm more interested in the life of older women,
mm-hmm.
because it feels like older women are more interesting to me, because I guess I'm not saying I've become a more interesting person, but I feel like the older I get, the less sure I am about things, and there's more nuance and grays. You learn that things are not black and white.
Yes.
And I think narratively speaking, it's so much more harder to depict those kind of life-changing muddling and like this sense of like borders melting. Mm-hmm. I think that's way harder to depict on screen or in books than like just like writing about a young woman like trying to find herself, and she's just like coming of age is, mm-hmm. I feel like coming of age is easier to write than a very complex older person.
Yeah,
you know,
I guess it's because when you're older there's a lot of options and you make decisions through, I guess there's a lot more intersections throughout the life.
Exactly.
And the social responsibilities come with it as well. As you get older, you'll have the responsibilities of more people, say, for instance, like your parents, or if you decided to have a family, you'll have responsibilities of your kids, you'll have responsibilities of whatever the work that you're doing. And I think it is quite interesting. Like you just said that these shows are very white-centric, but speaking of other shows that I've seen in the recent years, like, for example, we talked about Tokyo Girl,
which was amazing.
That's a brilliant series. Yeah. And also, this hasn't translated, hasn't had English subtitles as well, but I've always talked about The Making of Ordinary Woman. That's a Taiwanese drama as well. So it's a, it's about a woman who's entering her 40, big 40, and she's gone nowhere, and she was supposed to be married, and then the engagement was off. So it's like a chaotic situation that happens almost at the same time when she was turning 39 and the year of her becoming 40, and how she's like starting to think, I'm getting nowhere, I don't have anything, I don't have a house, I don't have a family, and I have nagging parents back at home where she used to work in Taipei, now she's going back south. It's very interesting series, but I think I'm just hoping that you would eventually have English subtitles because it's so fun to watch.
Can you tell me where to access it?
Oh, yeah, I'll send you the link. But if you can only watch it in Chinese and Taiwanese.
That's okay. I can still get the gist of it.
Yeah,
I think.
And because that drama done so well, I probably repeated so much in our previous episodes, is that because it goes through three generations of woman. It talks about her earlier childhood, and it's a comedy. Essentially, it's a comedy as well. But there's bits and pieces that are so poignant, and only woman who grew up in Taiwan, or Asian woman who will get it.
Yeah.
Do you know, remember that I sent you a clip where there was a scene that the protagonist was having a flashback of her first period, and then the mum gives her the pad.
Coming in.
And telling
and
her...
the grandma comes in?
Yeah, the mum's telling her that, you should stop having cold water, don't drink ice stuff when you have your period. And, you know, and the grandma start telling her that, you'll have period pains, you know, you have this pain, that pain, all sort of shitty things coming up in becoming a woman. And the little girl says, why is it so exhausting being female?
A woman.
And the grandmother and the mother says that, that's right, it's shitty being a woman.
And then she said, is there anything good about being a woman? And then the grandma and mum immediately just say, nah. Blah, which is Taiwanese for
but it's nothing. It's funny and sad at the same time.
That's really interesting. Well, let's wrap it up for now. And
did you want to mention Honey, I Brew Up the Kids?
Oh, okay. Yeah, we finished the trilogy.
Trilogy.
So last week we started Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, and then it goes from that to 1980. I think that's a 1987 film. 1992, Honey, I Blew Up the Kids, which is like really cute. They blow up little Adam. It's a very cute film. I think that was pretty funny. And then the last one made in 1997, which is quite like, I guess like quite, no, not quite a big leap, 4 years later-ish, is Honey, I Shrunk Ourselves, which is only like an hour and 10 minutes, which is very short. Like, I know it's such a short film, but it definitely didn't feel like that. And what I think this film is quite amazing is just this one scene where Alison Mack, who plays the daughter of one of the main character's cousin, I'm sorry, brother. So she's like the niece, I guess, of Rick Moranis. She like has a party. She has a house all to herself. She brings her friends. Mila Kunis is in this film as like a 12-year-old. It's really sweet seeing all these women, all these like people we know so well now as like kids.
Mm-hmm.
And Alison Mack, who, you know, is most famous for being in that cult Nexium, which, you know, we won't get into here, but she plays this character who makes a phone call to a guy she has a crush on because they're playing Truth and Dare.
Yes.
And then this young boy, like 12 years old, he rocks up at her house and then they kind of dance, flirt, and then he asks her to join him in the kitchen where, like, they're talking, and then he suddenly, like, kisses her, and then she completely reacts badly, as in, like, she freaks out. She's like, I didn't ask you. You didn't ask me if you could do that, you know. And I remember, like, she basically is like one of the best scenes about consent, you know, and it's very so prescient because, like, we're talking about it now, all these sex education and consent, mandatory education now, you know, being legislated. But it was such a miraculous scene to see in almost 30 years ago, you know, 1997, to have the scene. And I remember as a kid watching the scene and, like, being jolted by it because I thought, of course, that's how you want, as a girl, I thought that's how I wanted men to, like, boys to act around me.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just like, they make the first move.
It was so really bad education.
Yeah, I remember seeing it as a kid up. And I was like, oh, why did she freak out? Like, doesn't she want the guy to do that?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, watching the scene now is like, wow, this is pretty fucking amazing. Like, this girl really has all the language that we're now using, you know, in 2022. Jesus, fuck yeah. So it's just out of nowhere. This scene is quite interesting. And I guess I would love to be able to kind of canonize this scene as something we should look up to as we move forward into, you know, as our government moves forward in trying to construct or build this this education program on consent, you know?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of things that we already learned from the movies, which is pretty much very toxic when we were growing up, and then out of nowhere you have something very different.
I know, exactly. A
different type of thinking that
you could
express yourself in another way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful scene.
Okay, let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about a very heavy topic.
Yeah, I mean, it's heavy, but also I just want to preface our discussion about adoption. So Helen and I are going to talk about adoption. What I really want to focus on today is really the logistical, practical, administrative aspects of what it's like if you're interested in to adopt a kid from Taiwan as a New South Wales resident. So it's just purely this podcast episode from now here on is really it's very informational. So a lot of the stuff I'll be talking about is really taken directly from the New South Wales government website on adoption. And we'll go into detail after the break. But yeah, thank you for prefacing that, Helen. Anything else you want to add before we take a break?
No, that's it. Yeah, let's
take a break. Okay, we'll be right back. Hi guys, we're back. So this is Jess.
And I'm Helen.
And you're listening to Asian Bitches Down Under. We're going to chat today. Really, the reason why I've been thinking about this is a lot of what I've been researching is quite superficial, as in...
They're not superficial.
No. Oh, well, like, I just... What I mean is that this topic is so complicated and so complex. And
yes.
the thing is, it's always changing. So these kind of adoption laws are always changing. So I just want to let our listeners know that this is information that is current and relevant as of April 2022.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, just listen to this episode and just... I want people to use this as a way to go into their own research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because everyone's situation is different.
Yes.
And I just want to let people know that, and, you know, through the information I'll be giving today, really the basic things that you need to know, who's barred from adopting from where, who's not, you know, things like that. And also let listeners know that I have had quite a few correspondences with adoption casework from the Department of Communities and Justice,
mm-hmm.
who are the department government that, you know, are in charge of adoption. And they are very, very proactive with emailing you. So that's all I wanted to kind of say before I go into the nuts and bolts of this conversation. Helen, was there anything else you wanted to add before I start?
Well, no, I don't have anything to add, but I just had a kind of like a question to ask. Why did you choose to pick up the topic of adoption? I know we spoke briefly last year because I read Nicole Chon's All You Can Ever Know, and that was like a huge, not a huge impact to me, but it was something that the story that I don't read like every day. It's not white centric, and it's written by an Asian, and because we started to read a lot of Asian works the past 2 years, and basically a memoir that's written by an Asian adoptee but of a white family. It's quite interesting to me. I really want to hear her perspectives and see how she feels and how that would change society and surrounding around a lot of issues around race in society. But that's not what we're going to be talking about today. So what about you?
So Helen, next episode is going to talk about the kind of cultural pieces of artwork that are out there of a lot of American, like, this is something that I want to say about, if you're a listener in Australia, adoption and adoptees in America, and like Asian adoptees specifically, they're very prominent. Mm-hmm. They have so, because I think because of just, you know, because it's America, and because of the history, you know, Korean War, so many things, they have a way more stronger network of adoptees.
Yeah.
And that community is just absolutely out of this world compared to what we have here. Mm. For all reasons you can absolutely just assume yourself. But yeah, like I think the reason why I've been fascinated and wanted to talk about just kind of like the logistical parts of this is because I guess I'm getting older,
mm-hmm.
and I guess like I've been thinking about whether or not I guess I'm facing the reality that I might not be able to give birth naturally if I wanted to give birth naturally. Like, that's a whole other story I haven't really, I won't go into, and because I haven't really processed myself.
Mm-hmm.
But like natural conception and all that, I guess personally speaking, obviously, if I wanted that, I would choose to have that, I think. Mm-hmm. But if it didn't work out, because I feel like because I'm getting older, the option for me to go down that route is actually becoming a reality, you know, mm-hmm. actually realizing, oh, I'm like 40 in 5 years' time.
Mm-hmm.
I might not be able to conceive naturally. So, and like, because when I was younger, I always thought if I can't have a child myself, I would just adopt. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought if I wanted to be a parent, I would adopt. And like, it's something that I just kind of threw out as like an option, a plan B that was assumed as though I could get it if I want. Just kind of like, if I felt like apples one day, mm-hmm. I could just pop down to the IGA and get apples, you know, mm-hmm. no dramas.
Yeah.
But then, like, one day I sat down and I thought, okay, let's just, like, literally half an hour free, I just thought I'll just, like, spend a few minutes and do a very, very, very basic Google search of, like, what are the barriers to adoption if I did want to go down that route, you know? And I was faced with a lot of interesting things, Helen. Like,
very just, complicated, isn't it?
Whoa, wow. It's very, like, so the issue of adoption is very complicated. Mm-hmm. It's very intricate and complex. And each state has it very differently with each country we, Australia, partners with. So every country has a partnership with other countries that, you know, allow inter-country adoptions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like I said before, it's always changing. And again, like I'd say, obviously, we'd recommend you to go to official websites for your own state, but where you will be guided in the right direction. But I'll launch into things right now. So in Australia, the partner countries we have there are 13 partner countries you can adopt from, children from.
Okay.
And this, and before I list them, I'll say this is, if you do, this is like if you don't have any ties with the other, another country.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yep.
Yeah. So like say if you are from Jamaica and you want to adopt a kid from like someone of your blood relative or something like that, if you have some sort of connection, obviously there are other means for that. But mm-hmm. this is just for like people who have no connections
yes.
outside of the country. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the list of countries you're eligible to adopt the child from are in alphabetical order,
mm-hmm.
Bulgaria, Chile, China, Colombia, Hong Kong, India, Latvia, Poland, South Africa, South Korea, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and our very own Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I heard in many, many, many years ago, I thought, oh, great, Taiwan's on the list. Mm-hmm. Like, we could adopt from our own country if we wanted. But what I found very interesting is, like, when you click on all these links, immediately at the top tells you who can adopt and who can't. And a lot of these, and what I'll be talking about specifically today, is the page on Taiwan.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
According to the New South Wales government at the moment. So what I found surprising, Helen, was that in Taiwan has two organizations you can adopt from.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the Child Welfare League Foundation, which is an NGO, and the Changi Social Welfare Foundation. And I believe one of them, I don't know which one, is a Christian-based. And so for that reason, who can adopt? Only married couples can adopt. Mm-hmm. And you have to be married for at least 2 years. Some of them are different, 3 years some. Who can't adopt?
Can I just put
really quickly. You can only adopt if you're married for at least mm-hmm. 2 years. And if you're in a same-sex couple, you can't adopt. And if you're... in a de facto relationship, you cannot adopt.
Mm. You know, I only came to know that the Australian citizens can adopt Chinese children only a couple of years ago when I first moved up to Central Coast.
Yeah.
The second day, this is my story. The second day we moved in here, I took our kids to a local park, which is just across the road from our place. There was a huge playground there. And I came across with a white mother with three boys. And the youngest was an Asian. And I immediately know that, yeah, okay, it's a adopted child. And then the mom start calling the child and Chinese name, Yong something, I can't remember. But because the first character is same as my kid's character, Chinese name. So I picked up this like Yong Sen or something. Yeah. Anyway, and because... I was the only Asian face in the playground. She approached me and started talking to me about, oh, so where you're from, how old are your kids? You know, just the usual initial conversations between like two strangers, stranger parents at the playground. And we started talking and she told me that her youngest child, her youngest boy is... from Taiwan. She adopted him a couple of years I think a year before.
Okay,
so the child was a similar age to my youngest. I think they were both three or maybe a little bit younger at the time. And she told me that there's actually a church institution that goes to Taiwan and adopt kids as a group. So apparently you have to be Christian, like what you said, that one of the institutions in Taiwan is Christian. So it's very religion-based. And I do feel like a lot of adoption agencies are like that as well. They're very, very religious-based. And she was telling me that, oh, you know that up on Central Coast, there's a lot of Taiwanese adoptees. I'm like, what?
Really?
I don't know at all.
How have you never told me this?
Oh, I probably mentioned it briefly to you, but I didn't really go into detail because we actually, the mom actually exchanged contact with me, but we never really catched up because she invited me to church and you know how much I dislike church events. So I never really caught up, but she did on our first, you know, on that encounter, on that interaction, she did tell me that, oh, we do have a lot of Chinese kids that's adopted in Central Coast, and we meet up occasionally to talk about culture and things like that. But I didn't really I didn't get the vibe that she wanted to introduce me into that group. Not because I'm not a part of like the adoption circle, but I do get a vibe of, because being Chinese myself, she feel like this is only my assumption, you know, this might be not what she was thinking, but I think there's kind of like a gatekeeping sort of feeling for me, as if because I'm Chinese myself, but she didn't want her child to interact with someone who can maybe show the kid the culture beyond what she can do. I think she told me about the experience that, my whole family went to Taiwan. We stayed there for 2 weeks. You know, Taiwan is such a beautiful country. We did this, we do that. And then we pick up our child and then we came back. I didn't get the sense of she really wanted to know the background of the kid. I think it happens to a lot of adoptees, Asian adoptees, who are adopted into white families, that the white family probably just didn't put enough effort into. This is, you know, beyond what we're going to talk about today. So this, I'll be talking about it next week. I think it goes beyond to the race and the complications between the adoption family and the adoptees. So that's
so interesting. Heartbreaking. So heartbreaking, but I feel like this. But I feel very. I quite admire the way you were able to deconstruct that really strange interaction, because there must be a lot of weird power dynamics going on there. Because she is the mother.
Yes.
And you, as someone who is a blood native of her child, her guardian child, that must be quite scary and threatening.
Just
by your blood and how you look, you are more akin to relating to that young boy, whereas she doesn't have access to any of his internal, all of the history of that young boy's body, you know, you are closer to. So of course she'd be a bit like, she'd have some weird thing where she would like to bring you into her life, but also not bring you so close that you would be in competition with her, you know?
Like, I wouldn't think of like that. But
no, of course.
At the same time, I can understand that she's not going to love this child any more less than her own kids.
Yeah, of course, of course.
We hope. But I feel like there's always a very strange dynamic. After reading the story of Nicole Chan and also other Asian adoptees, like there's... Yeah, a very, very complicated dynamics between, you know,
and I think being very different
to your family.
And I would think what is so useful, not useful is the wrong word, but like what's so valuable about hearing Asian adoptee voices is because they can speak to, and their experience is sort of like an undeniable example of racism. You know, if a kid grows up in a family where all of his parents and his siblings are white, and then he still, you know, says, you know, like, I'm just giving an example of I forget his name, but he has a very cool name, a US gymnast who was adopted, I believe, from Korea, and he has been very public about like all the stuff that he experienced racism wise when he was growing up, because like nobody looked like him. All the kids were white, and he was teased because he didn't look like his siblings. Yeah, and it kind of reminds me, Helen, of Celeste Ng's Little Fires Everywhere, you know, that book, and also the TV series starring Reese Witherspoon, where we do have a subplot of one of the main characters, her friend, is trying to adopt a Chinese baby, you know, and her Chinese baby is, you know, being adopted. But then the mother comes back, and it's like one of the sub-genre sort of subplots of that book is, you know, who is the better mother, the person who actually gave birth to the mother, or the mother who has the financial means of giving the child the best life that it can. You know, it's a very sociological and maternal social investigation, I guess.
Okay, I found out the genus name is Yul Madua
or something, he's awesome, I have a picture of him as a baby on my desktop that I look at every day when I open my laptop. I know that's kind of weird, but he kind of looks like Russell, like our nephew. That's why I really like him. Like, I just think, I just, you know, when I see little Asian kids, I'm just like, I think in my head, I want a world where little Asian kids can grow up and not have to face all the effing shit that I faced. Mm. And so that help motivates me to do better, you know? Or to just speak out against racism, yeah. Okay, so coming back, I guess children in need of these children in Taiwan in need of inter-country adoption. This is the list of the things, the different categories of children that they have listed on the website. So they are toddlers up to the age of 3 who have complex and medical social issues, including birth family with mental illness, psychiatric problems and intellectual disability, maternal drug abuse, such as heroin or amphetamine, neonatal abstinence syndrome.
What's that?
I don't know. Maybe do a quick Google search while I run down the list of the other ones. Premature birth, hepatitis C or B, correctable health effects, medical conditions or physical issues, undernourishment from neglect, physical abuse, and older children and siblings grouped age 4 to 7 with complicated social histories. So it's really quite wide, I guess. You never know what you might get or what is out there. And these kids live in government supervised foster homes or institutions, like Helen said before, often religious institutions. A lot of these children have often some developmental delay. So there are specific eligibility criteria, like I said before, to adopt from Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to kind of fit a lot of different molds. Like I said, you need to have been married at least 2 or 3 years. It depends on which agency you go with. You can't have been divorced more than twice. So strange. It's so strange. But I get it. I get why these legal things are there. You can't be in a same-sex relationship or a de facto couple.
That's just so fucked.
Yeah. You can apply if you're single, which is interesting. It's like single people have more
rights,
have more cachet than... Yeah. It's, anyway, yeah, you don't need to hear me rant about how awful these things are. And also the age is important. So both you and your partner need to be under the age of 50. and the age gap between you and your child that you adopt must be between 20 and 50 years. You also have to be in good health, so they consider it. It says you can't have any kind of mental illness. It says mental illness, but it is preferred that you are no longer on medication if you once were.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like really ostracizing people and, you know, mental illness, full stop. And you can't have been diagnosed with depression for 3 years before applying.
Wow.
I know, right? It's so...
There's so much restrictions.
Oh my gosh. Okay, there's more. Education. You have to have at least graduated from high school. Which immediately I was just like, that's fucked up, because I know someone who is uber smart and she never finished high school.
I'm going to say everything about this at the end
is discriminatory. Let me finish the list. You can't have more than 4 children of your own if you want to adopt. And finances, you and your partner, you have to have a stable occupation. And what does that even mean?
Yeah, how do you standardize
stable occupation? Yeah.
And income. Yeah.
And that is the list. That is a rundown of the first social group, the CWFL. But in the partner group number 2, the Che Yung Social Welfare Foundation, this is even more extraordinary. You should have a BMI of less than 30. So it's like discriminating against people who have a BMI of more than 30. It's like, what? Why does that even matter?
Yeah.
It's
this is so fucked up.
Okay, so I just want to run down before I hear from Helen. Waiting times. So I looked through all the other countries, and some countries wait times are up to 9 years.
Jesus Christ.
9 years for some countries.
Which means that you need to start applying if you're...
When you're 20.
20 or there were 39 will be your... When you're 39, that will probably your final year to apply.
Yeah. That just absolutely confounds me. I don't know anyone who would wait 9 years. Like, people's lives change in 1 year, let alone 9, you know?
And you apply for what's going to happen in those 9 years.
Exactly.
Your partner doesn't want the adoption anymore.
There's so many things that could happen.
Pregnant with your own cute and things like that. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay, so in Taiwan, waiting times are up to 3 years,
mm-hmm.
apparently, when Taiwan accepts your file, and who knows how long it'll take them to accept a file, you know?
Mm.
There are shorter waiting times if you're adopting with a child with special needs.
Mm-hmm.
And the cost. So the estimated fees, and this is in US, I should be able to do it in my head somehow, but US, it's between 5,000 and 14,000 US.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say like between 10, 25 grand
yes.
to adopt a child.
Mm-hmm.
And Helen, let me hear what you say, what your thoughts are so far about or what I just said before I speak.
Okay. First of all, I looked up neonatal abstinence syndrome.
Yep.
It's a group of conditions caused when a baby withdraws from a certain drug he's exposed to the womb before birth.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So, okay. You know, the mother will be possibly be taking some drugs and then during the pregnancy. Yeah.
Okay.
Something like that.
And I just want to also say before I hear your thoughts, sorry, all the fees, the estimated fees I was just describing, they don't include translation fees, travel fees, accommodation fees, incidentals.
It's just for the agency. You know.
Exactly.
It's like paperwork, administrative work. Yeah.
Okay. And I'll bet to you all those other fees I just mentioned will probably be more.
Of course.
Or as much or even more than the quotes I've quoted.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
My first thought when I saw the list that the requirement to just go through adoption is that only if our society goes through the same or similar criteria for people to have kids.
I love
honestly,
this one. I freaking love
it. It's just so different. Can you imagine, like, you're governing, you know, people who wants to adopt because they feel the need to have kids in their life, but they cannot. But whereas kids popping out from vaginas every day from irresponsible adults.
Oh my god.
Or even kids having kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Or it's just like there are generational issues there, you know, sometimes when we see in some families. But I don't want to speak badly about them, but it's just like the overall governance of adoption seems so strict, whereas there's no control about how people have kids nowadays, and we're seeing children being abused from their biological parents as well. What do you say about that? How are you gonna, there's no enough controls or governance around people who are going through domestic violence and people just having kids freely, but it's just so different. I know
what you mean, but also, like, I don't see a world where that can happen, Helen.
Yeah, I know.
You know,
yeah,
there's no way that we can control people. And I don't want a world that controls a woman's choice, right?
Mm.
But I totally know what you mean when you say there seems to be, there's so much, like all that list I wrote, there's so much regulation about being a parent, and yet there's no guidelines or recommendations or kind of, there's nothing at all around how to be a parent in a straight couple. Or exactly. If you're a straight person, it's so easy to just become a parent. And you have to have zero criteria.
You have to go through trainings, even with becoming a foster parent. You have to go to trainings, you have to go to examinations. People come and visit you and inspect your places. But I'm listening to so many complaints from women about their partners who cannot fucking change nappies or who just couldn't do the basic parenting tasks. So you do wonder, like, is it really a choice? Eligible? Yeah, how can they be eligible at all?
To have kids. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's so right. I feel like right now, Helen, just on a personal side, I feel like Billy would be the perfect person to be in this conversation because he has taught me a lot about the absolute patheticness of straight couples who have kids with zero kind of criteria. Like he just said, there's so many basic people out there who just, if they wanted to, they can have children so easily. They can have, like, I think more so the conversations I've had with him are the criticism in which he has towards, like, the sharp eye he has towards, like, the way in which parenthood within, because mostly, you know, let's just say it straight, mostly it's like most of the world's parents are straight mm-hmm. or like in straight heteronormative relationships, right? Mm-hmm. And his attack mostly has been on the fact that parenthood is so fucking solemnized. Like there's so much solemnity
mm-hmm.
and taciturn. You know, the sort of, oh, he's a parent. Like, wow, this guy's a father. So like, you know, how when people uh-huh. talk about, you see like even President Obama's bio, like the first thing that
everything is about the father.
It's like father
of three, father of two.
Like mother of three. Mother of, as
it's like everyone's credit. Identity. It's almost
exactly.
the credit that you get being the human
exactly.
in the society is because that
motherhood.
You give birth to a person. Well, that's, I know that is such a wonderful thing. It should be celebrated, but it shouldn't come as a fact that there are a lot of people who cannot become a parent as well.
Yeah, exactly.
They have troubles
and
of becoming a parent.
And that doesn't mean that they're any less... You
yeah,
know,
they're not less
capable or
exactly
brilliant
yeah.
as a human or less valuable.
But we see it,
you know?
So much
yeah.
here, what you just
oh,
mentioned.
Oh, yeah, totally.
The differences between adoption and having kids naturally, the disparity, you know,
is
between
insane, yeah.
two situations is just insane. Because I can honestly say that there are a lot of biological parents. They are shit parents.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
They don't really deserve to be parents, but
yeah.
again, our society yeah. allows people to have kids really because it's in the human rights, exactly, I know that.
Yeah, it is a human right, yep, yep.
But then you're coming back to, you know, governance on people who wanted to have kids but cannot. They had to go through all this training, the procedures, 9 years waiting to the
yeah.
point that most people will probably give up.
Yeah, 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 exactly. This discussion we're having is going down a path I did not expect, and I really like where it's going down, because like I do question. Imagine there's a world where like there's a society or a government
mm.
where like you have to go through training and cultural awareness and sensitivity and emotional intelligence, all those courses
mm-hmm.
that foster parents have to go through. Imagine if straight couples were forced to go through all those things before they became parents. Imagine if straight men were like forced to take
fail.
Like
they will fucking
to take
fail
a nappy
first.
Wrapping lessons, know. You know, or things like that. Or like being made to sign contracts that said like you will do like half the amount of child minding
mm-hmm.
as your female partner, something
yes.
like that. Wouldn't that be amazing?
That's what I've been thinking.
I
want to write something. I really want to write a story, something like that. I've been thinking about for years about why we're still seeing so much complaints from the woman in cis heteronormative
yeah,
couples.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's no really a change. There's no progress. I don't feel like there's enough progress. I know that within my own little circles that with our own families that we're seeing the male partners are doing a lot more than our previous generation, but I'm still hearing so much and it's becoming so excessive to the point I'm like, well, should I be happy that I'm the only one around my own social circle that my male partner really does a lot of things? Should I be celebrating him, or should I be just considering that sometimes it's just a fucking bare minimum, you know?
Yeah.
But a lot of men out there that just doesn't do enough or not doing it at all in a relationship as a partner and as a parent as well. It's just,
yeah.
I feel like it's, I don't know if it's going backwards or is it really going forwards. It's really hard to
yeah,
tell.
Yeah. Yep,
yeah.
Yep, yep, yep. It is very hard to tell. I completely sympathize with everything you've just said. And I do wonder if all the couples out there who have trouble having kids or conceiving or like have no idea how difficult it is for people who cannot give birth naturally
mm.
to know all the things that they, all the hurdles, all the hoops that they have to jump through, how they would feel about. Sometimes there's a unreasonable resentment I feel to couples who just have children so easily. And I know it's not reasonable for me to feel this way. You know, because who knows, I could be one of those people who, you know, the moment I decide to be a mum, I get pregnant, you know, I probably will start resenting myself. I don't know. It's just, it feels as though there's a really big imbalance between people who want something a lot, like very strongly, a desire to be a parent, and are denied it for biological and social reasons.
Yes. Not everyone and can afford it.
Yeah, exactly. It's ridiculous. And the way in which, sort of like what I feel like I'm not really getting my point across, just like kind of the easy way in which straight couples can conceive if mm-hmm. they want, and the amount of absolute reverie and respect and solemnity that they get automatically just from the ease in which. It's kind of like what I'm talking about is kind of like white male entitlement. Just like, you know, yes. they get so much reverence by so doing
just being
so.
Being white. Male.
Exactly. Yeah. Or being male. Or like, just like, yeah, it's just when I think about my privilege, yeah, like, it's like we over reward people for the things that they didn't have to work hard to get, kind of.
I get you.
And I guess like, I've seen this a lot in the spaces I've moved around. And this is something that Billy and I talk about a lot, and he sees it a lot as well. And he tells me, like, men in these corporate worlds have, like, female partners who do 80, 90% of the housework or the child rearing, and yet they get, like, 150% of the kudos of, like, fatherhood. You know, they're, like, praised.
Yes.
Like, when a guy comes into the office and is like, oh, my wife's pregnant with her second, it's like, wow, congratulations. It's like, wow, you've done your job. You've fucking come inside her. Wow, well done. And, like, she ends up doing, like, 18 years of,
maybe you know, more
child rearing. And yet the guy gets all the credit. Yeah. It's,
yeah.
And I hate that. And, like, and, yeah, and, like, when I was teaching in girls' schools, I would often, there were often kind of these male teachers who really, really banked on this kind of just absolute, a reverence that they received from all the women around them. Like, they would start speeches like, oh, I know I'm the guy, but, you know, I've got three daughters, so I know something about what it's like to, you know,
why teach girls. Why do they always think automatically that they know something just because they have daughters?
Yeah, I know. Because they're...
It's pathetic.
It's because, you know, because
I think it's almost like a misogynistic method to shield yourself from people will be criticize you later.
Exactly. Yeah. It's defensive, isn't it?
Yes.
It's a defense.
Yes.
It's defensive. And I also want to say I jar whenever anyone starts a sentence with as a mother or like as a father. You know, like I've noticed this a lot. The other day I was at a workshop, a panel discussion with a couple of women. Jenna Price was one of them, you know, SMH columnist. And she was like, she said that a couple of times. She would start a sentence with, as a mother, I feel like this generation, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, why do you have to preface the fact that you're a mother? Why are you giving yourself, why are you stepping on that pedestal?
You have like, to put yourself in that position.
Yeah, in order to feel some sort of authority over me, just because I'm not a mother, like, I really find it very uncomfortable, and I hope that if I ever become a mum, I don't use that. I don't ever start a sentence with, as a mum. You know, it's just like, it's kind of like, it's such a flex. It's like, oh, so what if you're a mum? Doesn't mean you know more than me, right?
I think from speaking from experiences, you can't deny that there are mothers that will probably know more, but I guess it changes when you, because I'm a mum myself. And I'm trying to navigate the conversations that we have today. Not that I dislike my kids, not that I hate my partner, but it does sound like every time I talk about issues like this, my friends always think that, oh, do you have a really difficult kids to deal with? I mean, I do, but not to the point that the things that I talk about on our podcast or the things that I share on my social media. It's because I'm hearing so much stories. I'm hearing so much stories around me that I feel like, am I the one who got the lottery ticket? I won the lottery ticket that I didn't have to experience similar, you know, things like those women's. But at the same time, I feel like, no, I didn't win the lottery ticket just because my partner, my male partner, my husband does a lot around the house or really contributed as a team, you know, in our relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
It's because that I really talk to him and he is smart enough to know that he needs to change it's a process. It was a trajectory for us as well.
Yeah, yeah. But also, yeah. You made the choice.
Yeah, I made the choice.
You chose. Definitely. You chose him. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And I made the choice of that we need to be better. Like, I'm not going to put up with shit in my life.
Yeah, yeah. You know? But also, you're not blaming the women for not bringing up these conversations. Yes. You're not victim blaming.
I'm not victim blaming. Yeah. I'm just saying that how can we change as a society, as a whole? Yeah, yeah. And, you know, talking about it today also, this is not really going through anywhere. But it's really relative to everyone's life. As in, I'm just hoping that it will change for the better. You know, and I do hope that the children of next generation can have a better life than us. So that's why we're really unpacking all this shit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to circle back to adoption in Taiwan and just kind of finish off this episode by saying, kind of reading out an email. So I emailed the inter-country adoptions caseworker from the Department of Communities and Justice about my kind of just inquiring very superficially about, you know, I'm Taiwanese myself. Yeah. Like, I was born in Taiwan. I came when I was 5. I'm an Australian citizen. If I ever wanted to adopt from Taiwan, how could I do it?
Yeah.
Do I have any kind of special eligibility?
Can
I jump the queue? Exactly, Helen. Exactly what I thought. Can I jump the queue because I'm Taiwanese?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought maybe no, but he wrote back and he said this. Your connection to Taiwanese culture and language is highly regarded. It is great. It can be great benefit. It can be a great benefit to an adopted child to maintain connection to the country of birth, language, culture, and birth family. But and then he goes on to, you know, say, please note that Taiwan only accepts applications from married couples who have been married for at least 2 years. Oh yeah,
all those criterias.
This does not include same-sex couples. It's that's kind of all I wanted to say for this episode, at least. But I really like the way in which you made me think about, like the way in which this conversation turned and the pivot it took. I really like how you said, imagine if there were similar criterias to straight couples becoming parents.
Yeah.
I would say like the population of the world would halve within like a day. Or maybe not even half, like 90% of kids would not be born, you know?
More than half. Yeah. I just can't imagine. I cannot imagine just straight cis male going through those training. Yeah,
exactly.
And they, I'm not saying that I'm not hopeful for them, but at this current moment, the stories I'm hearing, I just don't feel like there's enough.
Yeah,
that's it from me.
It kind of, before we wrap up this episode, I know this is completely different, but you yourself, I just want to say this again. It's very different. I understand.
Yes.
But when you were talking about all the education and the seminars and the training that you need as a foster parent, you had to do a lot to be a foster dog, to be the guide dog's parent, right?
Yes.
Even that was like several months.
You have to have. We had like 3 inspections. Just people coming to our house. To check the fence, to check the house, to check the family members, to ask or not.
You guys use drugs?
I don't know. I don't think they asked that. But they check the environment of the house. Can you imagine inspectors going to a couple's house just before you're going to conceive a child?
Yeah, exactly.
And say and that, seeing, your house is not, you know, child safe proof.
Safe, exactly.
You're not going to have kids.
Or, I know.
You're taking some kind of, I don't know, kind of recreational drugs that you shouldn't have
drugs,
kids.
Yeah, exactly.
No one police people
who one polices hetero straight couples. Yeah, exactly. And like, you were looking after a dog.
I know.
Whereas, like, there's absolutely no policing of, like, people looking after human beings. That is so fascinating. I never thought of that. Dope, you're a friggin' genius. I love the way your mind works.
We should come up with this story about that.
I did not think of that, but you're, just brilliant. Just really brilliant, Dua. You're so right on that. It's not.
That's why I constantly say that this world is really fucked up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, okay, that's the end of our episode. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Google, and Apple, and give us a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support what we do here at Asian Bitches Down Under, head to our Buy Me a Coffee page and make a donation for us to continue the intersectionality in the podcast industry. Please follow us on Instagram at asian.bitches.down.under for updates and share with your fellow podcast lovers. I'm getting tongue twisted here, and we'll chat to you next time. Talk too much.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, we'll be back with another episode with Helen talking about the cultural aspects of adoption.
Stay safe, everyone. Bye.
Bye.